Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and reading with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
An exhibition called You Say You Want to Start a Revolution just opened in London at the Victoria and Albert Museum. It evokes the peace, love, and understanding that underpinned the hippie ideals of the 1960s. My guest today understands that revolution because she lived it. Originally from New Orleans, Pamela Johnson earned a degree in anthropology from UC Berkeley, a master's degree in education at Mills College, and English at Holy Names University, both in Oakland. She is a former teacher and university professor who has written a trilogy called A Nation of Mystics that recreates the psychedelic 60s. The hopes, the fears, and the naivete that was at the heart of those turbulent times. Book one of A Nation of Mystics is entitled Intentions. Book two is The Tribe. And the third book is Journeys. Pamela Johnson, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, this exhibit that I just mentioned is written up in an article in the British daily newspaper, The Guardian. And I was wondering what you thought about that article.
Well, first of all, the article pretty much nails what was going on in the summer of 1967. It begins by talking about Margot Fonteyn and Rudolf Nureyev, who were arrested at a party shortly after they defected from the Soviet Union. At any rate, they were, of course, released, probably a different type of government than in the Soviet Union at that time. But it goes on to talk about what was going on in the city, why that couple, that famous couple, was even here. And there were anti-Vietnam protests, there were African-American revolutionary movements going on. The Black Panthers were getting started in Oakland. They were actually a wonderful organization, feeding kids in the morning, making sure that the community was protected. The Oakland Museum will be doing an exhibit on the Black Panthers coming up pretty soon, and we have the 50th anniversary of their evolution, so the Oakland Museum will be working with that idea. There were a lot of rock concerts going on, the Fillmore and the Avalon, Big Brother and the Holding Company, with Janis Joplin, Jefferson Airplane, Grateful
Dead. So this
Dead.
Article was written in a British newspaper, but
right.
Did you find it accurately reflected your experience?
Well, yes, in some ways. This is about technology mostly, and I don't think at that time people were really talking about technology.
Yeah, they do connect it with the Silicon Valley movement.
Right, exactly.
But I did notice that, having read your books, that a lot of the terminology, the way they describe, the way they characterize the late 1960s in the Bay Area, did reflect your characterization in your books.
Well, yes, I think so too. And of course, they go on to talk about Steve Jobs and what was going on, you know, with him and his LSD experiences. And
but that's not what's in your book. So
no,
I was just asking
about
the Guardian article and if they characterized the movement there, the revolution in the Bay Area accurately.
Well, actually, yes. The thing that was going on in the Bay Area that was so revolutionary, outside of experimental writing, was also experimental art and also experimental music. But all of those music concerts had a lot of melding lights and light shows. And this is really the beginning of a big cultural differentiation between going into a theater and sitting down and watching music and something new that was taking place.
Well, I mentioned that you were from New Orleans. So how did you even get to the Bay Area to begin with?
I was working in the civil rights movement in the South and in New Orleans, and
I bet you were really popular among the locals.
It was.
What about in your own family? Did they go along with your ideas, Pamela?
No, not really. And that is one of the reasons I think I came to California. But when I was doing work at LSU in Baton Rouge, we were threatened quite a bit. The girls in my dorm room wing got together and burnt a cross outside of our room one night. It was a dangerous time. You didn't walk home alone at night. But I also knew that what we were doing was the right thing. And so I also knew that what was going on in California was a large demonstrations, people gathering, and I wanted to get out here and see how California could motivate so many people to action with all the intentions of going back to LSU.
Louisiana State University,
yes,
where you were a student.
Yes. And
but, well, I assume you were because your character, Kathy, in the book was a student at Louisiana
yes,
State University.
Yes.
She comes out with a friend, Marcy. Now, did you come with a friend or did you come alone?
I did, but it wasn't someone like Marcy. Marcy's based more on my dorm room mate, who was a very dear friend of mine. But when I got out to California, there were lots and lots of other things going on. I came out at the end of 1966. I went back to LSU. In fact, I moved over to the University of New Orleans in New Orleans. I began the Student Liberal Federation there and didn't last very long in the South. I knew I needed to get back to California. So I came and wound up living in the Haight-Ashbury during the Summer of Love in 1967. So I had a front row seat to a lot of what was going on, the concerts, the street people, Golden Gate Park, Hippie Hill, all of it.
My guest is Pamela Johnson, and she has just completed books 2 and 3 of a trilogy, A Nation of Mystics, and book 2 is The Tribe. And she just said she herself arrived in Berkeley, 1966, and your story starts in January of 1968.
Right.
And she's saying that there's two approaches that people could take. If they were dissatisfied, they could either drop out,
mm-hmm,
or what was the other option?
Well, there was a great deal of difference between what people thought in San Francisco, which was more flower child and you are careful when you walk on the grass because you don't want to hurt the blades of grass.
Which is where you were. You were at Haight-Ashbury.
I was in the Haight-Ashbury, but I was also back and forth to Berkeley. And I had a political consciousness, and I knew that the changes that were being made in the Haight-Ashbury, peace and love, were also part of the anti-war movement. Now, hippies also had that back-to-nature part of them, but that was, in effect, a way of trying to create peace and creating a lifestyle. In fact, there's a scene in my book where these people have moved out to Humboldt, and they've had a day at the river. And I think it expresses pretty clearly, here, I'll see if I can find it here in my book, just how people felt.
It's page 167, by the way.
Oh, you're so good. Okay. All right. So these people have spent the day taking LSD at the river. They have, they're standing on a rock. They're ready to go home. They put their arms around each other, stand in a circle, and then they, I'll just start reading here. "We have time for a prayer," White Bird said softly, watching him with Greta. She put an arm around Greta and reached for Big John. Then Russ was at Marcy's side and Spirit on the other, and all the children, everyone forming a circle. In the hush of the early evening, the powerful vibration of the ohm lifted up and out, reverberating against the canyon walls as powerfully as the sound of the river, the hum of the vibration of the universe, the beginning and the end, absolute reality, embracing all that exists. Merlin took Rosie and silently turned to the trail with Greta. Marcy and John followed. Tonight there would be hot tea and food from the garden they had made. Tonight Merlin would make a fire in the fire pit and smoke from his pipe and blow magic rings. They would lie under the stars and pass the pipe, watching the firelight play across the faces of their children. Tonight they would play guitar, and she would sing with him under the stars. On the morrow, they would begin again to learn to live in harmony with the land and pray that their actions would be bring peace to the earth. So this was one part of that psychedelic movement, people going back to the mountains to grow their own gardens. And of course, many of them are still there. Today, lots of them have different kinds of gardens as well, which is another political issue.
The other, well, I was wondering, too, in your book, when you're talking about the area, the Haight-Ashbury in San Francisco, and you mentioned places like taking time out to have coffee at the Café Mediterranean And I was wondering if that was a real place or did you
make
up that name? I thought it probably was. But I also noticed at one place you mentioned a highlighter, and I thought, was highlighter in 1968? Because I thought that came along later.
It might be. I'll have to Google that. Thank you.
My guest is Pamela Johnson, and her second in a trilogy, A Nation of Mystics, book two, is The Tribe. Now, when you mention psychedelic, there's a name that is, you can't help think about psychedelics without thinking of Dr. Timothy Leary.
Right.
And so for people who might not know, who was Timothy Leary?
Dr. Leary was a Harvard professor who began doing work with psychedelic research and was eventually expelled from Harvard and decided to take his show on the road. There's a very good documentary coming up called The Sunshine Makers, and it will be released, I think, in December. But it's all about Nick Sand and Tim Scully, who were the 1969 makers of Sunshine, Orange Sunshine, LSD, which is supposed to be the best in the business. Well, Dr. Leary decided that there were two ways he could go. He could keep his experiments among a small group of intellectuals and have people look at it from a spiritual and perhaps a medical point of view, because he was looking for ways to deal with depression. Or he could give this amazing experience that he had found to the world, and he decided to go public with it. In The Sunshine Makers, you will see that there were two different peoples who made LSD and where they're at today. One of them believes that LSD does not really, was then. And the other one believes that LSD is still very powerful. And so they live their lives according to those two premises. And the movie's fascinating, and I encourage people to see it when it comes out in December.
Well, your book gives, for people who maybe are against drugs and, drugs are bad.
Yes.
Your book presents a different view that cultures for centuries have used psychedelic, psychoactive, drugs, plants.
Right.
For religious,
right.
For spiritual reasons. And you have a chapter in your book where one of your characters makes a trip and he goes to see a shaman. And what happens? Why did he do that?
Well, I think we need to get back, before I talk about that, I want to get back to the issue of drugs and psychedelics. Many people feel that psychedelics, especially during the 60s, especially among the Brotherhood of Eternal Love, which was in Southern California, many, many people in the hate, that these were not drugs. These were sacraments. And I was reading through some reviews on Amazon the other day on my book, but what someone said very succinctly was that the book showed the whole frog, warts and all. and yes, there were lots and lots of problems. It's not a panacea. The books are not a panacea about
that all drugs are wonderful.
Yeah, it isn't. But it does try to look at them in a realistic sense. Now, there are four groups of people in this epic novel that I've created. There's the communal family and all of those people who come from different parts of the world. But there's a group from Berkeley. There are two graduate students and a professor who has grants to do research. And of the two graduate students who are best friends, one becomes an informant for the narcotics agents and one becomes a shaman. And this little bit that I will read here about this particular group in the book, and of course these stories are interwoven, they are down in Mexico and they are with the Mazatecs. And the character Jerry is eating mushrooms, and the shaman, the woman, Maria Guadalupe, is going to guide him through it. Even before Maria Guadalupe had finished eating her share of the mushrooms, Jerry's eyelids became heavy and flashes of light pierced the dim room. He blinked hard and turned to Benjamin, who smiled reassuringly. His body started to sway. A hum began, the oscillations again. From where? He closed his eyes and sat straighter. As the altered state became familiar to him, he could not single out this mushroom experience from other psychedelic journeys. The moment came when the veil separating him from knowledge lifted. He could not move. His breathing became shallow, his eyelids heavy, closed to reveal shimmering patterns of light, shifting, reforming, symmetric, patterned. As each moment passed, each longer and longer, his world became the square rug he had chosen and his vision one of soft, bright color. Out of the darkness, Maria Guadalupe's voice entered his world. He clung to its sound, its cadence, and relaxed. Maria Guadalupe would lead him. There was nothing for him to do. Her voice was part of the oscillations, part of the low humming. The sound carried the room, and she became the focal point of all the minds in that sacred space. "These are the mushrooms who love me," she had told Benjamin, speaking of the psilocybe cubensis they had eaten. Now Jerry could appreciate the countless voyages of discovery Maria had taken as she tried all the different psychoactive varieties. So Jerry goes on with this trip, and it takes the reader through it. And at one point, the air snapped, startled. Jerry opened his eyes and saw Maria Guadalupe's hands moving to an unseen rhythm, clapping, cracking the air, matching his breathing. In between the beats, he heard murmurs of low conversation and the noise of babies in the room. Were the children on the cement floor of the Mazatec village or on the dirt floor of Africa? He knew as he asked that it did not matter and began to understand Ben's theory that pockets of knowledge were stored in different parts of the world where they had always been, waiting. People like Benjamin Miller and Barry and himself would seek them out and bind them into a rediscovered body of wisdom. What was it that guided their investigations? Why unbury secrets that native peoples had hidden for centuries? Why was higher consciousness important to people now?
My guest is Pamela Johnson. She's reading from A Nation of Mystics. It's the second of a three-book of trilogy, and this one is called The Tribe. Now, I'm assuming that you were not present at such a ceremony yourself, but I assume also that this had some basis in reality. Is that true?
Well, yes. People take psychedelic mushrooms all the time.
But, did you know of somebody that maybe went to Mexico and...
Yes, absolutely.
To experience what Jerry, character Jerry does in your book.
And I also have taken mushrooms. So I can speak from personal experience that there is an altered state of consciousness, and there is that ripping away of the veil from ordinary reality.
Well, you also have the opposing viewpoint, and that is the people whose job it is to make sure young people are not taking drugs.
Yes.
And so there's a guy named Joe O'Brien in your book.
Right.
And he gives a speech
in
your book.
So I've spoken about the communal people. I've just spoken about the people from the university, but there are also two other groups. One of them is a group of attorneys who defend many young clients, and this is new. These drug laws are brand new. LSD did not become illegal until October of 1966, for example. They're a brand new group of attorneys that are dubbed the drug attorneys at that time. And for five years, I lived with a man who was an investigator for these attorneys. So I saw many of these issues up front, some of these scenes up front, and a lot of this is true. And then there are a fourth group, the state narcotics agents, which are basically taken from the things that I saw at that time. Okay, so what we have is a trial, and the defendant has just been released due to the investigative work of Joe O'Brien. And the attorney in this case is named Lance Borman. And so he comes up to the to the narcotics agent after school. His name is Dolph Bremer. And he says, well, after trial. And they're standing in the hallway. And he says, I know this was a hard case to lose, but I can't say I'm sorry. And Bremer looks at him coldly. And so the people in the hallway start leaving, the people from the trial. Who's the lackey? Bremer points his chin at Joe O'Brien. Him, the investigator. Borman shuffled uncomfortably and cast a glance at Riley and Hansen, who are two other officers, who looked equally uneasy. O'Brien stepped forward, smiling. Allow me, Lance. I'm Joe O'Brien. My card. Bremer looked briefly at the card and, without touching it, asked, is that grin permanent, or do you sometimes wag your tail for Borman, too? I work for myself, O'Brien said, still grinning. Apparently, my work's too good for you. It's your kind of work that helps to destroy decency. You think that's funny? O'Brien stopped smiling. Decency? You're right. There would be nothing funny about destroying decency. But quite frankly, I have to question just what decency means to you, Supervisor Bremer, especially after what I've learned about your police tactics, your personal vendettas dragging down an entire police department, prison sentences for men and women based on lies, your total disregard for due process guaranteed by the Constitution, your very questionable affidavits, your abuse of power. O'Brien's voice was hard and clear and carried through the hallway. People stopped to listen. I don't think your prime motive is to preserve decency, Agent Bremer, and I'm going to make it a point to see that you stay within the letter of the law from now on. Yeah, Bremer answered loudly, loosening up his shoulders, his hands fisted, the edges of his vision dim again, everything dropping away except the words, this asshole's presumption to teach him the law, the smirking face, the craving to take the guy down to the floor. Dolph. Hansen's voice reached him, penetrated the black fog. Bremer blinked, looked into Hansen's uncertain expression, but O'Brien, like everyone else in the hallway, had seen his fist, read his face. Ha! O'Brien laughed, his eyes shining again. You still don't understand, do you? You'll follow due process, or I'll destroy you. Not with your weapons, fists and guns. I'll destroy you and your kind permanently with my ideas.
Author Pamela Johnson reading from A Nation of Mystics, her second in the trilogy. And you said you had direct experience, knowledge
yes.
of some of this segment of your book. And
yes,
how
is
that?
This isn't a conversation that actually happened. I did hear that. There was quite a bit of undue process going on at that time. And it was because of attorneys like Lance Borman, who is a character in this book, but probably based on several of the drug attorneys, but because of men who had courage, because of course they came after the lawyers afterwards, and several of them were indicted on trumped up charges, or you know, at least they were harassed. Their houses were searched. Lots of informants were sent in there to try to get them to do illegal things. But because of their courage and because of a few very good judges, things did tighten up. A group of thugs with badges could not go and take the law into their own hands and make their own rules.
Pamela, in your book, you tell us that Kathy was motivated by Dr. Martin Luther King. And this comes up in your book because they discovered that Dr. Martin Luther King has been assassinated. I'm guessing, Kathy being your alter ego, his assassination maybe influenced you?
Absolutely. I was in high school when they had the Birmingham church bombing and the little girls were killed. And, you know, looking at the faces of those parents, I think that was the changing factor in my life, because I was in an all-girls Catholic high school, you know, and we, you know, we knelt on the floor, you know, to make sure our skirts were the right length, and we never talked back to a teacher. And suddenly I have decided that I'm going to go against the entire tide of my Southern culture and start promoting desegregation. So, yes, that part is about me. And I think you've raised a very good point that this is not just a drug book. It's a book about the 60s and all those many, many, many levels of experience. Let me read this one part that just when Kathy finds out that Martin Luther King has died, she's sitting on a beach in Mexico. She's taking a break, first time in a really long time. She's been working really hard. Several times she opened her mouth to say something, to tell him how Dr. King's inspiration had moved her to action, how he had been a source of her political courage. Suddenly it was all there, rushing into memory with all the force of a sledgehammer's blow. The nights at LSU when she and Marcy had feared to walk home alone, the telephone hate calls, the threats and obscenities, the looks of sheer loathing as she walked the picket lines, distorted, twisted faces and jeers, the heart-thumping fear she'd felt as she stepped forward to do the right thing. From the time she'd heard Dr. King's words after the little girls had been killed in the Birmingham church bombing, she had followed him. He had counseled peace, even in that terrible, soul-wrenching tragedy. What he had done and said on that occasion, this loving soul in a body with black skin, this man of God with a mighty vision for the future, everything had been absolutely true. The dream he'd envisioned had become the dream of millions. With tremendous courage, knowing he might not make it to the other side, he'd stood tall and strong and shown the way. She could only stare at Larry and then to the sea, her own eyes filled with salt tears. Larry took the paper from her, still reading. There are riots in 100 U.S. cities. 20 blocks have been burned in Chicago. 9 people have been killed. Larry, what are we doing? How can we be here when the bombs are still dropping, while there is still so much work to do?
Pamela Johnson is reading from the second in a trilogy, A Nation of Mystics, The Tribe, and her character that she's following that has a lot of similar qualities as Pamela herself is in this scene in Mexico. And one thing you do to help the readers, because there are scenes all over the world, one country, another country.
Right.
And so you help us by each chapter. You tell us where we are in the world,
right,
where our characters are. You also tell us when it is, mm-hmm, what month in 1968 and 69, because you're following these different characters. But you also help us with the different characters because there are so many that you have somewhat of a glossary in the back that you forget, okay, who was Borman and who was Joe O'Brien? And so you can flip to the back and see who the character is. You also have a glossary of terms that those of us who don't know about the drug culture, that's all foreign language. And so you also have something in the back for those of us who might not know what a lid is. And so we can flip to the back and find out. So I want to ask you about Kathy and her experiences in Hawaii, because this was also quite a profound experience when she goes to Hawaii. So I want to ask you about that when we come back. We're going to take a short break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, Pamela Johnson, who has actually written 4 novels, Heart of a Pirate, which is the story of a woman pirate named Anne Bonny. And then what we're talking about today is her trilogy, A Nation of Mystics, and The Tribe is book 2, which we've been talking about what's in book 2, and book 3 is called Journeys. So, Pamela, I mentioned that your main character goes to Hawaii and has a very profound experience in Hawaii. So would you, that's on page 238 in your second book.
Okay. Well, in addition to the politics of the period, this communal family who is passing out sacraments, the issues that are going on in and around Berkeley, there are also people who are going around the world, as you mentioned. Some of them are going to Afghanistan to bring hashish back. Some of them are going into ashrams in India. So there's also a spiritual search going on here, and I think that that's the bottom line of all of these books. How do you express your creativity and your spirituality during the 60s? So Kathy takes another vacation. We just talked about one in Mexico, and she has been going to school. She's back in school. By now we're into 1968, 1969. These children who came to the Hate as very young people are growing up, and they're beginning to change. And one of the things that changes Kathy is meeting a young man, and they are in Hawaii on Haleakala Crater. They have an LSD experience there. It's the very, very end of the day. They've been up since morning. They've been hiking through sun. Part of the sacramental experience among Native Americans is just this sitting in sun and fasting, and they have been doing this. They passed one of the cinder cones on their way out of the crater. Then another reached a second cabin. Water a short break, and they continued along the trail. Kathy knew she was moving slower than the others. One by one, Bob, Lisbeth, and Dharma passed her. Ahead, she could see Christian's anxious glance and the bottom of Lisbeth's thongs as she disappeared over a low rise. She tried moving faster, caught a glimpse of the party at the top of the hill ahead, and already they were moving on. Christian waited for her at the bottom of the valley, but before she reached him, he started walking again, making sure he kept the others in sight. Now the place where they walked was barren, and the thought of hurrying forced Kathy to move without focusing on the minute crystals of rock or the occasional bright yellow flowers that appeared out of black sand. "Keep moving," she ordered herself, and she did, until she reached the top of the next rise and caught a glimpse of the setting sun, a sunset such as she had never seen before. The vibrant motion and color lured her, a moth to the flame.
Now, we mentioned this Hawaii, but there are various islands in Hawaii, and I don't think we mentioned that this is Maui.
This is Maui.
And people who travel to Hawaii kind of know the difference that Maui is a, dare I say, more spiritual?
It is a very special place, and I think it's because of that volcanic crater there that really created the entire island, place before man and seed and birds and trees. So, yes, Kathy, Christian called, but she could not move. Instead, she sat down on the small peak and watched as the sun touched the edge of the earth. Christian walked back and squatted beside her. "We should get moving," he said gently. "Can't, not now," was all Kathy could manage. 10 hours of sun and fasting, consciously dropping the largest dose of acid she'd ever taken, had brought her to this place. Native Americans had held such ceremonies for thousands of years to induce the mystical experience, and now that the union she sought with God was so near, she couldn't worry about the time of day. She had to go with it.
This is Pamela Johnson reading from A Nation of Mystics. Book two is The Tribe. And he mentioned that Christian understood what was happening. He knew that ego death was a difficult thing to experience, sometimes terrifying, closely approaching real death. And then a couple of pages after that, he gives his opinions to answering the question, is there death? And he's standing there, he and Kathy are standing there, and there's this Lama Lodin, who was his mentor, and he says, "Lama Lodin once told me that coarse impermanence, death, does exist, but its causes can be researched and confronted. Even though we don't want to die, we can prepare for it and be less frightened by the process. But while the mere self or mere I is produced from matter and may travel from one lifetime to another, Consciousness is an entity of luminosity and knowing. It can only be produced from one moment of another moment of luminosity. Consciousness is a continuum without beginning or end, without death. Now, these are words coming from a young man whose father was a minister and expected his son to be a minister. And Kristen decided he didn't want to do that.
So Kristen grew up in India at an English boarding school. And while there, one of his professors there had a friend who was a Tibetan Lama. And for several years, Kristen basically studied with his Lama without his in meetings, without his father really knowing. And then, of course, went off on his own to study as well. When he graduated from high school, he had a choice to make. He could either go to the United States and follow in his footsteps and become a minister, or he could choose to take refuge in this Lama and go live in a monastery in Nepal and become a monk. At that time, he had decided to go with Lama Lodin because the power of the mind was all exciting to him.
Now, was this character based on somebody that you knew?
It's another
composite.
It's another composite. And then there's a terrible riot in Amritsar, and things happen. And Kristen is shuffled off to the United States by his parents right after high school. And then he does wind up going into this this Christian seminary and for a semester, and that's when he decides to leave and go to Berkeley.
Well, now, when he's talking about answering this question, is there death, Kathy replies, can you imagine non-existence? Try to turn off yourself. Try to snuff out your own tiny light. There really is no way for your consciousness to die. Your Lama was right. We may lose the body, but never the soul. And tonight, if we should die, it'll be all right. If this body dies, it'll be like we just kept on dripping.
Yes, because this psychedelic experience is very spiritual. And I think that that is, of course, once again, as I said, the underlying themes to these books. But yet, there are things that go with them. And I think if we move to book three, as we watch these people changing, Kristen and Kathy have an argument. Kathy goes to Arizona to do her business. Kristen decides he's going to Afghanistan with some brothers to smuggle some hash. And he winds up getting arrested. And this is what I would like to talk about. As he's in prison, this is what he's thinking. So he goes from this place of spirituality, of wanting to become a monk, of still looking for a way to live his life. I'm on page 196. The prison worker idled slowly past him. Once he was in the hallway, the door slammed shut loudly, the sound echoing down the empty hall, and Kristen was left standing in the deepening darkness. The allure of years of adventure, work, and love called to him from the tiny sky-filled window. The humiliation of his capture suddenly overwhelmed him. Hadn't he just told Kali, another friend, this would never happen, that he was very careful? Alone, staring at the door, for the first time in a long while, he began to question his abilities. His legs gave way, and leaning against the wall for support, he slid again to the floor. The aluminum cup of tea sat near his hand, and he greedily drained the bitter brew. One look at the curry, and he knew he would be sick within the hour. Better to fast. Everything had started slowly, imperceptibly, he reflected, experimenting with pot, the thoughts and revealing visions, the power of the acid experience, sharing with friends, the knowledge that others might benefit from the experience. Each time he passed a dose to someone, he felt as if he were sharing Lodin Rinpoche's teachings. At first, the money he made wasn't really his. It belonged to the business, to getting the work done, to helping brothers who were in need. But as his business grew, it couldn't operate without capital. Money was needed to purchase chemicals and equipment, rent buildings, provide transportation. Albert and Doug, his chemists, were counting on him. So were dozens of others. Slowly, the money had become his because he had the ability and knowledge to use it. But in exchange, it had seduced him. Slowly, subtly, It had given him mobility, license, and freedom, and he had come to rely on it, often thought of it as the means to an end. Somewhere he had lost his way. Somewhere in the challenge of the next deal and the excitement of handling large quantities of product and money, he had been lured from the humble life he had once contemplated. He was egoless each time he tripped, subject to the power of the universe, to God, reduced to the very cells that made up his body. But each trip also served to increase his vision of himself. Only a handful of men in history had seen and understood with the depth acid bestowed. He had known he was among them. He had become egoless, only to take more pride in knowing his greater abilities because of his visions.
Author Pamela Johnson is reading from Book 3 of A Nation of Mystics. Book 3 is entitled Journeys. And this was a character who found himself arrested in this prison. And you present a whole range of characters. And I'd like to go back to Berkeley because there is an iconic park there that people might wonder, well, why is this empty lot there in Berkeley and why did people, what happened there?
Well, there was a lot of student housing there. And it was cheap housing. It was close to Telegraph Avenue, half a block off of Telegraph Avenue. There's just a series of stores that separate the park from Telegraph. And the university tore the housing down because they wanted to move the youth subculture off of the university area. So they thought getting rid of housing or cheap housing would get rid of this undesirable youth. Well, the vacant lot sat there for quite a while, and one day a committee got together and decided they were going to create a community park on this land. And if I can go to that section.
This is on page 313.
Okay. The university runs Berkeley, says one of these committee members named Andy, the way the auto industry runs Detroit. Exercising enormous power, controlling the very substance of people's lives, a word here, a dollar there, and whole neighborhoods go. Where is the playing field they were going to build for intramural sports or the faculty offices, the parking lot? Where's the residence halls for the students? That was the excuse for destroying the homes. I'm telling you, that mess of a lot has sat for over a year. There was no pressing need for the bulldozers to plow over inexpensive housing. The university simply likes playing Monopoly, buying up all the property, spreading out. But you can believe they're not going to go into the hills, into the white neighborhoods. They're going to attack the weak and the vulnerable. So Andy starts pacing, and he looks at a paper on his desk, and he starts talking to Kathy about what is going on with the Board of Regents. Ronald Reagan and three regents controlled 20% of, well, not Ronald Reagan, but three regents on the board controlled 20% of Orange County, 285,000 acres of Kern and L.A. counties, and large areas of Coachella. He went on to name other regents, Everett Carter, who had the directorship of Del Monte, AT&T, Pacific Mutual Life Insurance, Southern California Edison, the Stanford Research Institute, Norton Simon, McCall's Reader's Digest, Canada Dry, Edward Polly, head of Western Airlines, Ellen Grant, who was head of the California State Board of Agriculture, and being board of agriculture automatically gave him a position on the Board of Regents. These men, Andy assured her, are members of the corporate elite who would systematically break the backs of the poor for profit. Better to have a bottom line on a piece of paper for your shareholders and bonuses for management than to ensure that a Delano farm worker's child gets milk or goes to school. His speech was stumbling, as if he couldn't find the words. So confounded was he by the sheer magnitude of the greed, he cried, "Kathy, workers are sprayed with pesticides. There aren't even toilet facilities in the fields. After a grueling day's work, they return home to rundown shanties covered with tin, without indoor plumbing or electricity or the means to cook. And for the privilege of working for the growers, they're paid the exorbitant wage of 90 cents a day plus 10 cents a lug. That's $10 to $15 a day. When men like the Regents want something, nothing stands in their way, not people and certainly not homes. All the Regents and the university need to do to own anything is claim eminent domain, and then they can usurp the land. But this time, we're fighting back. This time, we're taking back what's ours. The park's not about land. It's about ideas. It's about the people who have to struggle for their share against the people who keep control of the God Almighty dollar. Men like Reagan and the Regents must be stopped somewhere. We'll stop them at the park.
So Andy is quite angry about this situation, and he starts this rant by saying that the university doesn't own anything. They ripped off the land from the Spanish, who ripped it off from the Indians. The people are only taking back what belongs to them. Communities should be places that minister to the needs of the people, particularly the poor and the working class, those without financial resources, not the wealthy, the people who already have enough and want more. So that's what he says as he starts this rant. So we get this scene about the People's Park, which is world known at that time. And then a little after that, Kathy learned something about violence and demonstrations. And what does Kathy learn?
She has watched things happen during the demonstrations. James Rector is killed. Alan Blanchard, an artist, has died. 29 people were taken to hospitals with gunshot wounds.
You're talking about at the People's Park.
Yes, at People's Park on one day, 29 people were taken to local hospitals. 74 other people were with park-related injuries also taken to hospitals.
Now, these are horrifying statistics that you're giving us, Pamela, and I'm assuming that you didn't make these up.
No, no. The book is very well researched. Everything in here from the color of an acid tab to the number of people who went to hospitals is completely accurate to the time. And so, you know, she says to Andy, she's horrified as well. And she says, so much for the revolution. What do you mean? Andy's anger lashed at her. I mean that doing something really revolutionary means doing something different. Hate, anger, and fighting, that's all been done before. We already knew the results before we started. I just don't understand why we played the game. Jesus and Gandhi showed us the true nature of real revolution, the kind that makes permanent change. Martin Luther King, and now Cesar Chavez. So I think that this actually fits into the music that you were talking about and also the title of the Guardian exhibit. So you want a revolution.
Of the exhibit at the Victoria and Albert Museum, written up in the Guardian.
Yes, exactly. Sorry. So you want a revolution. Of course, this is what the Beatles were singing about in that time, exactly what Kathy is experiencing or suggesting in this paragraph. This paragraph here. I'm not saying that we give up, Kathy told him, but whatever method of change we use has to be nonviolent. Look at Cesar Chavez's hunger strike last year, 28 days without food, only water, until the macho younger men finally understood. Nonviolence forces you to find creative alternatives to old games. Sure, getting the grape strike going was a lot of work, but Middle America's joining in and supporting the workers. Kathy shook her head. Somebody died today because we wanted to create a park where things would grow.
This is Pamela Johnson reading from the second in a trilogy, A Nation of Mystics. This book, too, is The Tribe. And a lot of people were injured and at these riots. And it's upsetting the way that whole thing came about who the people were who would doing the shooting.
Right.
And you have a section on that, the politics of the National Guard and of Ronald Reagan, a couple of pages on in that chapter.
Well, each group of law enforcement, and there were several, there was the Alameda County Sheriff's Department, the Berkeley Police Department, California Highway Patrol, the University of California Campus Police, nobody had control, or there wasn't a single commandant or commander. So a lot of authorities wanted to blame what happened that day on a lack of communication. but
and coordination between the different groups.
Absolutely.
Called in.
So that evening, our group in the novel is watching television, and the chancellor of the university, says the TV, Robert Hine, has relinquished control of the situation to police. He could not be reached for comment because he is out of state attending a conference.
Now, that's easy because here's Andy again. He was the one that was angry about the People's Park.
Right.
And he's the one that's saying, this chancellor set us up. He let them clear the park, and then he got out of there so he wouldn't have to deal with it.
Exactly, and which is obviously true. In view of today's distressing events, the TV commentator continues, Governor Ronald Reagan, claiming that the university has become a haven for communist sympathizers, protesters, and sexual deviants, has ordered 2,000 National Guard troops to maintain control in the city. The city of Berkeley will be under martial law until further notice.
Well, now, I was thousands of miles away when all this was going on, and I did know to some degree it was bad, but reading your book was kind of shocking.
It is shocking. What happened the next day, too, it's the first time a helicopter came out of the sky and it sprayed pepper spray, which was one of the gases used in Vietnam at that time, on the crowds. It's the only time in American history where American citizens have been attacked from the air by its own government. It was a very big deal.
And this also, I didn't remember this. Governor Reagan said today, if it's a bloodbath they want, then let it be now.
Yes.
That's shocking, to say the least.
Yes. And of course, he got the impetus from in the conservative arena off of his actions during People's Park, basically, and which eventually propelled him to the presidency. And then, of course, he took the same stance during the 80s while he was there. And that might lead us into a thought or two about the next book.
I saw, I was an observer from a distance. And so I didn't have any emotional reaction to things that Reagan was doing. But I had a close friend who was at Berkeley. And he really, to this day, hates Ronald Reagan.
Well,
I can see now where that would students at Berkeley would be,
yes,
would feel that way.
Well, he also sold off a lot of donated treasures to procure funds for the university. He raised tuition rates. It was a way to get a really good education without having to go to Stanford, basically, which was very expensive for California's best students. And it's a challenge today because the rates have continued, I think, as you know, to go up.
Well, this is what takes place in the book two, the second in your series of three books. And what gave you the idea to make three books instead of just write a book? And in fact, it was quite a few years after. That was a long time ago that these things are taking place. Uh-huh. How did you even remember? Did you make notes at the time? Did you have newspaper articles? How were you able to write these three books this long after the events took place?
Well, I started writing in 1980. I had my third child at that time, and then I was going to be a stay-at-home mommy. And still needed something to do. I'm not very good at sitting and washing clothes and doing babysitting. So I did all of that and enjoyed it, but also needed that creative element. So I started writing this book. And I went to UC Berkeley Library at that time. There were no computers. I went through the stacks. I went to the Berkeley Public Library. They had all of this information in folders, in manila folders, old newspaper articles. Nothing was scanned or electronic at that time. So, yes, I've been doing this since 1980. It's been a very, very long road.
To distinguish book two from three,
yes.
Book two is, it's hopeful because these young people in their youth think that, we can do this. And in book three, enough time passes, they begin to see, here's the reality of the situation. And it's going to be hard work. But you do open book three with Woodstock. Mm-hmm. And I'm so glad you included that. I enjoyed reading that. But what was your source or sources for your chapter on Woodstock?
Oh, I was there. I was. There's not a whole lot in this book that's not true, although there's no real characters. Though everything is basically a composite.
Well, now, when you say there are no real characters, you mean that you've created these characters, but
right.
There was Swami Satchidananda,
oh, right.
A real person.
Other than the historical figures, yes.
Yeah, Janis Joplin, of course, a real person. Jimi Hendrix uh-huh. was there at Woodstock. So we
lots
remember,
of people.
Yeah.
I think I go through the concert.
In fact, at that time, there weren't many books on yoga. And now I have tons of books on yoga. But the very first yoga book I bought was Swami Satchidananda.
And I think it was mine as well, I have to tell you. And when I was living in Berkeley as a very young woman, that was the yoga class that I was taking, yes.
Well, what do you have your characters do when? Well, for one thing, we know that it rained a lot.
Oh, yes.
There, and so they get there and they're just inundated. But they seem to take a rather spiritual approach to the elements. And I thought, well, that's a nice way of looking at it. Here they are drenched. Their blankets they're wrapped in are drenched. But how did they decide to view that storm?
Well, people were huddled under blankets, and I remember this moment when everyone just threw their blankets away and they grabbed each other, people they knew and they didn't know, and they started dancing. And then we just stood there, and everyone was very, very high. I mean, the entire bowl, hundreds of thousands of people were, you know, on a spiritual journey. And suddenly, for us, for our group, this helicopter came out of the air. And we thought, oh, my God, we had this terrible flash of paranoia. We're like, if they want to stop a movement, because we had just come from People's Park, you know, that spring, and this is the end of the summer.
Well, the helicopters were bad news.
Exactly. The helicopters were bad news. If they want to stop a movement, they could stop it here, you know, because everyone, this is the movement. This Woodstock is the movement. And, of course.
In fact, when I was reading your chapter, I didn't remember this, but I assume it happened. And so I thought, oh, how nice. So I was reading, I was in suspense, too, about these helicopters as I was reading your book. And then what were the helicopters dropping?
And they dropped flowers. And I still have my flower, in fact.
From Woodstock.
Yes, I do.
What a nice memory.
It's pressed in my program, mud and all.
Well, things are changing a lot. You read a section earlier about a young man, the character who was arrested in India.
Right.
And Marcy is changing her attitudes. And then Kathy has a different vision for the future. So as these characters, as you kind of wrap things up for these characters, you're working on another book now.
I am. The women are beginning to become part of that, you know, a big part of the hippie movement, and was very, very chauvinistic. I don't know how to say it. The men were, this is my old lady. She's doing the cooking and the cleaning and having the babies, and I'm, you know, and I'm going out to work every day with, you know, with my pound of pot in my back. Pack, you know, but these women are beginning to figure it out, and they're becoming our modern.
So the title of your new book is "In Violation of Human Rights."
Yes.
So you continue in your role as social and political activists. It's been a pleasure talking to you, Pamela, about your two new books in the trilogy. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.